Recordings have started.
Great. Thanks so much, Marie.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IGO Curative Rights Protection Mechanisms Working Group call on the 6th of October at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we do have George Kiriko, Jay Chapman, Philip Corwin, Mason Cole, and Paul Tattersfield. We have apologies from David Maher, and Lori Shulman will be joining us later on the call today. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Emily Barabas, and myself, Michelle Mislater. As a reminder, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you, and I'll turn the call back over to Philip Coleman.
Thank you. This is Phil. Welcome, everyone, as we continue to wind up our work. Anyone have any updates to their statement of interest? All right, hearing none. By the way, Petter will not be with us today. He's traveling today and cannot join the call, so only this co-chair will be on. And we're going to be reviewing a new draft of Section 6 of the report. This is the most important section, our preliminary recommendations, though the other sections laying the groundwork are also important, and we're waiting on drafts of those, and then we'll start reviewing them as well. So our agenda today is to try to complete discussion of the various policy options in the wake of receipt of Professor Swain's analysis, the potential applicability and use of the UNCTRAL rules, and the issue of cost for IGOs to use curative rights processes. And so why don't we get going here, and there is a new draft in the window, which I believe was distributed prior to the meeting. This new draft is completely clean, so can I see a show of hands how many working group members have had a chance to review this new draft, or is it something that most of us are if you've had a chance to review it, raise your hand or check off. George has had a chance. No one else. Jay has had a chance. And Mary, go ahead, Mary. You have something to say?
Yes, Phil, thanks. And apologies that in the PDF conversion that it seems to have put everything as a clean copy. But what I wanted to note for the working group is that to the extent we're looking at the policy options, which are on page 11 of the new draft, those have not changed in terms of the text from the last version that was circulated. We were awaiting further discussion before making any other changes to this section, or this subsection, rather.
Okay, so page 11, you say that hasn't changed. Okay. Well, why don't I do it? Why don't let me suggest this as a way to proceed. And Jay, you can uncheck that now. We've got not everyone has reviewed this. Why don't we just read the current? Has any of the text of the actual recommendations 1, 2, 3, et cetera, has that been changed from prior drafts?
Phil, I am looking back right now, and I believe that the actual text of the recommendations, that is the parts in bold, those have not changed. What has changed from last week is the accompanying text that adds more context to the bold recommendations.
Yeah, I'm having trouble, I'll admit, this co-chair, I'm having trouble figuring out how to proceed because there's nothing, we don't want to spend the entire hour reading through every word of this, but there's nothing to indicate on this PDF where we're looking at new language. So if there's a discussion of whether we're comfortable with a new language, I don't know how to identify it.
So this is Mary. If you want to look at just the options, then that would be the old language. But if you'd like to review the changes that were made to the preceding text, we can try and see if we can get a redline version up in PDF if you'll give us a few minutes.
On my desktop, I do have the redline version that you sent, the version of October 4th, which does show changes and comments. So let me reference that and take the group through the ones. I'm not going to go through the comments right now, but let me discuss where there's significant changes. And let me just go. Whoops. Okay. All right. Let me see what's being uploaded. It may be the same document as the one I'm looking at.
Yeah, we're trying this again, Phil. So
okay.
It should be coming up, and we'll. There you go.
Yeah.
So you've got the red line up now in PDF, if that's helpful.
Right. It is unscrolled. Let me zoom it up a little bit. Okay. So if everyone, this is much more useful. There's, as you can see on page 2 here, there's some significant changes to the language in the first full paragraph, which is an explanation of our rationale for our conclusion that the UDRP and ERS do not need amending in order to address the needs and concerns of INGOs, and that a new curative rights process is applicable to them is not necessary. So, and then the changed languages in point 2, unlike IGOs who may claim jurisdictional immunity in certain circumstances, INGOs are not hindered from submitting to the jurisdiction of national courts, et cetera. The working group's research indicated that some INGOs regularly use the UDRP to protect their rights. Point 3, there's the other substantive rewriting. Although some INGOs may be concerned about the cost of using the UDRP and the URS because enforcement through these RPMs involves some expenditure of funds, this is not a problem for all INGOs, nor is it unique to INGOs as rights holders. Furthermore, the issue of ICANN subsidizing INGOs to utilize DRPs is outside the scope of the working group charter. That language looks fine to me, the revised language. Anybody have any comments on that? Okay.
Hi, Phil. This is Mary again.
Yes.
So just to note that we left Paul Keating's comments in the document, and really it was just to be sure that the working group had considered the comments and the text and are fine with the text as is. Thank you.
All right. I'm just looking at those comments to see. And everybody else, take a look if you think there's anything Paul has said, he's not on the call with us today, that we should be discussing. All right, let me open up. Does anyone see anything in Paul's comments that isn't incorporated in the new language that they believe should be? I'm going to leave that question out there for about 20 seconds. And then move on if there's no input. Yes, Mary?
Sorry, this is Mary again. So just from the staff side, it seems that most of his comments were about the phrasing, and we've tried to be as accurate as possible. The other comment that he had related to adding more context, for example, what is the ECOSOC list and what are the organizations on it, and we plan to deal with that in the deliberation section that we're still drafting.
Yeah, and I thank you for that input, Mary. I think that it's more appropriate for that kind of technical detail to be in the introductory sections rather than the recommendation sections, would be my view. So let's move on to the next area. Page 3 is pretty well untouched. Page 4, there's some new language at the top under the UDRP and URS. The first substantive element that a complainant must satisfy under both procedures is that the complainant has rights in a trademark or service mark. So that's a little clarified. And there's some new language below that in red. It's generally accepted that the threshold may be satisfied by establishing either ownership or exclusive license rights in the trademark or service mark. So any comments on that? Okay. Then at the bottom, there's suggested, well, it's in there now, so that addition, the Paris Convention as an established procedure, et cetera. My only question is why that stops there rather than being integrated into the full paragraph that starts right after it. It seems a little strange for it to be a standalone sentence.
Hi, Phil, this is Mary. Are you talking about the bottom of page 4, the yes. Single sentence?
Yes, single sentence.
So I think here what we can do is include the procedure here or maybe a footnote to that procedure. And we could either, like I said, include the procedure here or is something that we could put in the deliberation section as well. But in either case, what we can do is look at making the change less abrupt.
Yeah, something where it's just not sitting out there as an isolated sentence masquerading as a paragraph. It needs to be connected to something else. All right, moving on to page 5. There's some revised language in the first paragraph, as discussed further below, and then a parenthetical in, and there'll be a cross-reference. The working group believes that this limitation reflects the other substantive grounds of the UDRP and URS, which require that the respondent have no legitimate rights or interest in a domain that is identical or confusingly similar to the complainant's mark and has registered and used it, the domain name, in bad faith. And that's a comment on the preceding sentence, which is about substance of the Article 6 tier, which references names, among other things. Continuing on, I'm just going to – is this another comment, Mary?
Yes, it is, Phil, if I may. And this ties in to the further discussion below under Recommendation 3. And I think some of Paul Keating's comments here are basically the point that we want to have a conclusion as to whether or not there is a match more or less between those remaining substantive grounds on the UDRP with the limitation in 6TER about the confusion caused by the use of the IGO's name. So depending on whether there's any additional text or changes to that, then we will need to conform all the references to that specific point.
Okay. All right. Looking at Paul's extensive, are these all Paul's comments in comment 10 and 11?
Yes, they are. Paul, essentially, the only comments that we've retained are Paul's, and I apologize to Jay that we haven't looked at the comments he lately made to the Google Docs. We didn't know you had, and we will look at them later today.
Okay. Okay. Well, Jay's on the call. If Jay wants to bring up anything at any point when we get to something to comment on, he should certainly intervene if he wishes to. All right, so from Paul's comments, is there anything we incorporate in the language, or has most of it been left out? The first part of his comment makes the statement that 6-tier doesn't provide for any trademark rights. You know, it's difficult to describe the 6-tier protections. They're not trademark rights, but they are protections within trademark systems. So I don't know if that first paragraph we could want to move some part of it into the full discussion just for further clarification. I don't think we need to reference all the language here. It might be footnoted, the actual language of 6-tier. Okay, and then let's move on to the next. His comment on 11, is it relevant to the refined language in the middle of the page? So as to enshrine this recommendation as part of a binding consensus policy and contractual agreement with ICANN's contracted parties, the working group recommends that a binding policy guidance document be prepared that will describe the scope of the standing issue for IGOs, as well as any other points that may warrant clarification should the Council and the ICANN Board accept these recommendations. Paul's comment says he has difficulties agreeing no additional documentation is required. Well, I don't know that we're saying it's required. I think we're recommending that it be done for guidance. I really personally have a difference with Paul on that. I see no harm in providing an additional guidance document to give guidance to the many IGOs out there regarding their standing to utilize the curative rights processes. Paul thinks the UDRP language is sufficiently broad. And it's also in the URS, I agree, but what's the harm in having a guidance document that points all that out? And that then explains that 6-tier registration should be sufficient to assert standing. So I'm fine with the recommendation as is, and we might add a sentence indicating that the clarification should reference the existing language of UDRP and URS and related to the language of Article 6-tier would be my suggestion. Okay, no comments from the group, so I'll continue to narrate. Recommendation 3. For IGOs, the working group does not recommend that any specific changes be made to the substantive grounds upon which a complainant may file and succeed on a claim against a respondent. In relation to IGOs, however, the working group proposes that the limitation enshrined in Article 6-tier of the Paris Convention be considered an approximation of the remaining substantive grounds of the UDRP and URS with respect to the required findings of the respondent possess no legitimate rights in the domain name that's identical or confusingly similar and has registered and used the domain name in question in bad faith. Paul has commented that it could be argued that paragraph C operates as a condition for the recognition of the right, and this condition presents a higher burden for the complainant because it's not merely a text versus text comparison, but necessarily includes establishing an element of confusion at the level of the public. I guess he means among the public. The confusion, my impression is that the panelists look at the actual use of a domain to see whether the confusingly similar domain name is being used in bad faith. So I think it's covered in that way. We might add a sentence relating those two things, but I don't think there's a higher burden of proof on a IGO complainant than there is on a non-IGO UDRP or URS complainant. Any opinion on that from the group?
Phil, this is Mary again. May I
yes.
follow up? Thank you. And this is something that we would, on the staff side, appreciate some guidance from the working group. We put in this language really to draw the group's attention to this substantive point, because we don't believe that this is something that has been discussed in as great a level of detail as some of the other issues that we've been discussing. One thing that we wanted to be mindful of is that our recommendations, as I think we'll all acknowledge, should not confer or create additional rights beyond what's already available. So given that 6TER seems to have this limitation, as we're calling it, and there are other substantive grounds under the UDRP and the URS, this is the reason why in the text that you see before you use the word approximation. We agree with Paul that it's not a text-for-text comparison. We don't have an opinion as to which is a higher or lower burden, but we just wanted to get a sense from the working group as to whether or not the fact that there is a limitation in 6TER and there are these other conjunctive grounds under the UDRP and the URS, whether taken together, that's kind of a similar limiting universe and doesn't create additional rights, if you get what I'm saying.
Right. So, well, what we're, again, all this is talking about standing. We're saying that an IGO which is not registered, its name or acronym as a trademark, can still go after an alleged infringer through UDRP or URS if it is registered identical, a domain that's identical or confusingly similar to the name or acronym, provided that the IGO has registered for Article 6TER protection, which is protection within national trademark systems of all the signatories to the Paris Convention as well as all World Trade Organization organizations. And by the way, is that is the signatory and WTO coverage mentioned here? We've been skipping over portions. If it's not mentioned, it should be, to make clear that virtually not all, but virtually all of the nations of the world have are tied to Article 6TER one way or the other. Is that in the text yet? If not, I would suggest it be added. So anyway, we're basically telling the UDRP and URS providers that if an IGO files and they don't have a trademark, but they're asserting standing based on Article 6TER, the complaint should be allowed to proceed. I can't imagine that any of those providers is not going to do that, is going to say it's insufficient. And then we're saying that they decided under the normal course of the UDRP or URS, which both require a finding that there's no legitimate rights or interest in the registrant in the domain name, and that it's been registered and is being used in bad faith. And the use in bad faith, I would think, and maybe we need a sentence to point it out, if you're using it in bad faith, you are trying to confuse the public as to the identity of the owner of the domain, and trying to confuse them that the domain is one of the IGO rather than one of the actual registrant who is not the IGO. I don't see a lot of daylight between those two, even though there's somewhat different language in 6TER and in the language of the UDRP and URS policy. I don't see a lot of daylight between them in terms of actual application by panelists. Does anyone else, does anyone think there is, and that we need to say anything more about that? Is everyone still awake? Well, Mary, go ahead. We know you're awake. I don't want everyone to be awake. I'm just trying to encourage some participants.
I see that Reg has her hand up, so I'll defer to her if you can come back to me after Reg has spoken.
Okay, sure. Go ahead, Reg.
Thanks. Sorry to take your spot, Mary. I confess that I have not been following this very closely, but I wanted to know if we think that this is going to be an appropriate substitute for simply reserving all IGO and NGO names at the
Excuse me? What's the question?
Do we think that this is going to be a replacement for reserving all IGO, NGO names at the second level? Because currently a lot of them are reserved.
Well, if they're reserved, anything that's reserved couldn't be registered as a domain name. But the reservation may only be for their full names. It may not be for an acronym, and it certainly wouldn't be for typos of either. So we still need, it's not a complete substitute. Reservation accompanied by blocking provides some degree of protection, but not total protection. That would be my view.
Okay, so the massive list of IGO NGO names that registries are forced to reserve is not going away. This is just in addition to that.
Let me mention here, it seems like an appropriate time. Staff just advised the co-chairs very shortly before the call that we expect within the next 24 hours to see actual text from the board reflecting some final outcome for their talks they've been having for well over a year with the GAC and the IGO small group on permanent protection for IGOs. We have no idea yet what the content is, so what the board wants to do about reserve names will probably be reflected in that document. Unfortunately, as a consequence of the timing, we don't have that document before us. I'm sure as soon as it is available that staff is going to share it with the entire working group, and we're probably going to want to devote our next call to some discussion of that document to see whether and to what extent it impinges on our work and what we want to say about that, but we don't have it yet. But, blocking, reserve names and blocking is different from ability to use the current curative rights processes when an allegedly infringing domain is registered, and even if both the acronym, full name and acronym are blocked, that wouldn't affect the possibility of a typographical variation being registered and used in bad faith. So they still need something beyond blocking because we're not going to block every typographical variation of full name and acronym. I would hope not, but we'll wait to see what the board recommends. Mary, let's go back to you.
Thanks, Phil. Actually, let me follow up on your discussion with Reg. So for the record and for those working group members that may not be following the whole topic beyond just the scope of our working group, the list of IGO names and abbreviations that are currently under reservation at the second level, those are interim in some ways, in the sense that for the acronyms, this remains an outstanding issue. So depending, as Phil says, on the outcome of the small group's work and its review and reception by the GNSO and the GAC, that could go away. Under the GNSO policy that was adopted by the board, the full names would still remain reserved. So in essence, when we get to the end of this process, we could end up with a combination of blocking type protections, for example, for the full names at the second level, and certain different types of protection for acronyms at the second level, which, Reg, I think goes to the essence of your question. So it would be, I guess, a holistic sense as to whether or not those are adequate, objectively speaking, and whether or not they are a replacement, I guess, would be a matter of opinion at that point. Then, Phil, going back to the question of this approximation between Sixter and the UDRP and URS, like I said, you know, we put it in there just to make sure that it got discussed. As you noted, though, you know, we're using Sixter for the purposes of standing. So, you know, essentially what we could do with this particular recommendation 3 is simply to just leave it as the basically the first sentence. So essentially we just say, look, we're not recommending any changes to the UDRP, and we're certainly not recommending any changes to the substantive grounds. We're simply saying that for the first ground, for standing, here's what would apply for IGOs. Then the question as to, you know, whether or not the remaining substantive grounds of the UDRP are the same or are not the same as Sixter is not something that we would address, but presumably that is something that as the jurisprudence evolves, then, you know, we would see what the limitation of those are under the UDRP. So this is just one other way that we can deal with this question as well.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Mary. And maybe, a thought to give staff a little more to do, because I know they don't have enough to do. Maybe we could add a sentence to the follow-up paragraph, which just, I believe it's the view of this working group that the, as I discussed before, the language in sixth tier, which requires establishing that the public was actually confused, that it's the belief of the working group that that would already be part of a finding of use in bad faith under the existing standards in the UDRP and URS. Clearly, if it would be hard to say that a domain was being used in bad faith if you looked at the domain and there was nothing to convince you that anyone in the public would confuse the domain with the complainant. Whereas if it's got content that includes the name of the complainant or has the logo or mark of the complainant and talks about activities of the complainant, well, of course it would be confusing. So again, the fact that there's that additional little requirement in the in sixth tier, I think, is covered in the actual examiner practice when they have a UDRP or URS before them. All right, so I have nothing more to say on that. So again, I was saying maybe one little sentence in that follow-up paragraph between the boldface of Recommendation 3 and the boldface of Recommendation 4, just clarifying that we think that's going to be found anyway if there's a finding of bad faith use of the domain. So moving on, we have some new additional language now, which is under Recommendation 4, which it has been the most difficult of our recommendations to work out consensus on and work out language on. And so I'm going to start below the boldface, and this is on page 6. In presenting options 1 and 2 above, the working group acknowledges that it is yet to conclude which of the two options represents the optimal approach. I think that's just good clarifying language. Dropping down the next paragraph, there's a new sentence. The working group notes that one reason for the belief is the fact that, as noted above, IGOs are able to file complaints through a assignee, licensee, or agent. So, that's going to be prior discussions, referencing prior discussion of how that can insulate an IGO from having to surrender its sovereign immunity if it believes that its sovereign immunity would be offended by bringing a CRP action directly. Continuing on, there's a new paragraph. The working group also notes that where a losing registrant proceeds to file a complaint in a court against the UDRP or URS decision, one threshold question that the court will have to decide is whether or not by submitting to the mutual jurisdiction clause, an IGO will be deemed to have waived any jurisdictional immunity it may otherwise have. Okay. I think that language is fine as is. I wonder if we should add an additional clause or an additional short sentence, which something to the effect that it just points out again that the decision on a claim of sovereign immunity will always be one that individual courts will have the decision on, that it's outside our purview to control what courts are going to say about that, and that we, as our expert has instructed us, different courts are going to come out differently in regard to that. Okay. And welcome Maurice Shulman, who I see has joined us in the chat room.
Yeah.
Okay. Then further discussion of option one, that's just a little grammatical thing there. A new bullet point. Will introducing this option, and this is the option where, okay, this is about option one where if there's a successful assertion of sovereign immunity, the original UDRP or URS decision would be vitiated. A new bullet point, will introducing this option also mean that an IGO has no choice other than to either risk giving up any jurisdictional immunity that may otherwise have in order to fight the appeal in court or allow the infringing conduct to continue by not filing a complaint in the first place. I'm okay with that language. Lori, your hand is up.
Yes, I have this radical idea, and I don't even know if it's feasible, but, you know, I'm looking in the chat, and I've entered late, but, you know, to Reg's point, and I think it's a valid one to say, it'd be terrible if .echo.fashion were somehow to be reserved when we're talking about a UN agency that's devoted to relief. Or and the great example that Kathy Kleiman has used often is WHO WHO, when WHO is a common dictionary word. And I, you know, I'm here to say this has been about the protection of names encompassing every single, to your point, Phil, iteration, spelling, meaning, whatever. What this is about is context. And I believe where we're really pushing at opposite ends here is that in order to put any protections in place, it requires modifying programs. Programs don't think. Programs simply have rules that they follow. Whereas proper name protection, proper trademark protection, proper protection under Article 6 TER all require some evaluation of context. What is the context? So on one hand, to George's point, it all, you know, it's prior restraint. In the broadest possible sense, maybe yes. But I keep going back to the fundamental protection of certain names used in particular ways is been part of the ICANN dialogue since ICANN's inception. And what I get nervous about and what I feel is not fair to brand owners, and I'm absolutely speaking with a trademark hat on, is that I feel that somehow this idea of context has gotten completely blown out of the water or ignored. And wouldn't it be a wonderful world if we could figure out some sort of methodology where we could consider context? And I don't know what that is, but I feel like particularly our group's small enough. We've been together now for, is it going on 3 years, I think, that when we take these final steps about what we're recommending, that if we take such a broad path to say, well, you know, in the case of IGO, which is entitled to a protection of its name to a certain degree, and then we add on top of that the fact that the IGO does have a degree of immunity that is a decision by a court, But to go and then have that right asserted, win, and then say if you're not willing to give up sovereignty, well, we go back to square one. To me, that just seems fundamentally unfair and against the spirit of what we've actually been asked to do. And I've heard George and I've heard Paul, and I do understand their points. I'm not sitting here blind to some of the things you've been saying. But I think there is a blindness sometimes to what we've been actually asked to do. And it's not an easy question, and I'm not saying it is, and I'm not even saying I have an answer. But I want to throw it out there again. Is there a way, can we continue to explore how we can fix a problem that requires formulas versus human evaluation in terms of, like, reserved lists or, in this case, you know, the issue of immunity? I don't know. But I'm throwing it out there because I feel that's my job.
Bill, this is Paul Keating.
Okay.
Sorry, I can't put up my hands. This is Paul Keating. Sorry, I can't put up my hand because I have.
Okay, Paul, we didn't know you were on the call.
I'm sorry. I agree with the sentiment 100% and 1,000%. Okay, I believe that was the original intent behind the first element of the UDRP. Okay. But the first element of the UDRP has been watered down to this quote-unquote standing concept. Okay? Because what you're noting is that properly trademark rights are viewed in context. Okay, but unfortunately, the way the UDRP has developed and every other curative rights process has developed has been to ignore that very concept, which I believe that Kathy and others, when they first drafted this, all the drafters of the original UDRP, I honestly believe that's what they had in their mind when they drafted that language. And unfortunately, it's been wiped off the planet. So for us to build that back in, I think, is not the confines of this working group, but perhaps the confines of the review of the curative rights process, which Phil is also a co-chair of and which I'm a member of. Okay, but I, given where we are, I believe that if you're going to assert sovereign immunity and thereby preclude the registrants from realistically having their day in court, you cannot rely upon this UDRP process because it was never intended to be that. Okay, so you have a choice, Mr. IGO or Ms. IGO. You can proceed with whatever rights you have. And if you're not willing to do that, then you have to live with the consequences of that choice. That's your choice. Okay, that's how I feel. Okay, but I really applaud your unless I misunderstood it, I really applaud your concept of trying to bring in context back into the UDRP process.
No, I you did not misunderstand me, and you're probably going to have some of my members maybe argue a different side, but I don't think so, because those who are frequent practitioners of trademark law understand that you don't have universal rights to everything on the planet ever, forever, and always. What my understanding was the UDRP was about is creating this carve-out, a small carve-out, a carve-out that requires bad faith. That is not
correct.
Any name,
and
it's
speedy.
Time. Right, and it's speedy, and not only does it keep brand owners out of court, but it keeps registrants out of court too. And that's always been, you know, one of my issues. I think George and I will probably have to agree to disagree on this issue till the end of time, but I don't see courts necessarily as better deciders. I mean, my experience as an attorney, courts make mistakes, administrative law judges make mistakes, but a lot of times the right decisions are reached. And if you have a decision with good processes and well-educated deciders, no matter what the forum is, you should have a reasonably predictable outcome of a dispute. And
The co-chair is going to intervene at this point to clarify some. Just there's a good discussion. We want to get back in a minute to to our review and also hear from Jay. I haven't forgotten you, Jay. Ori, what I seem to hear you saying is that the blocking, which is kind of a blunt instrument approach, we need a more sophisticated approach than that. I hear Paul saying that a lot of the context that Ori would like to see considered is not being considered in the current UDRP practice, and he correctly notes that there's an RPM review working group which is going to be looking at the UDRP starting in 2018. Also, for both of you, I don't know if you're on the phone when I mentioned a little bit ago that we got word just about an hour ago that later today we expect to see a communication from the board on the output from these discussions they've been having with the GAC and IGOs on both blocking and CRP for more than a year now. We have no idea yet what the substance of that is going to be, and or how we should react as a working group, or how the GNSO Council may react to some of it, because it was a discussion undertaken by the board when the Council and the GAC came out quite differently on some of these issues. So it's all in the mix, but our working group has no authority to deal with blocking mechanisms, whatever we... I guess we could have some dicta in this report in discussing the context we're operating in, which includes blocking of certain terms and acronyms at the new TLDs, but we have no authority to change any of that. And I'm going to call on Jay and then see who else wants to follow up with more commentary on this. Jay?
Thanks, Phil. This is Jay Chapman. Just getting back to the text and kind of where we were, and again appreciating the discussion that we've just had, and definitely would, you know, we'll take that to heart and want to you know, consider how and ways we might be able to you know, to bridge some of these original intentions and things of getting things to where they can be considered in proper context. Back to the text though, and in the specific new I guess paragraph, bullet point that was added here that begins with, will introducing this option also mean that an IGO has no other choice, et cetera. It seems to me that this particular bullet point is almost a restatement of the prior bullet point, at least the back half of that, the last clause of the previous bullet point. It seems to say the same thing, maybe add a little bit there. I just have a couple of comments on this specifically. One is that it seems to me that the, you know, when we're stating, you know, does introducing option one mean that an IGO has no choice? Well, as George, I think, pointed out in the comments, there's clearly still the choice of being able to, you know, find an use an assignee, an agent, a licensee, et cetera. And I don't want to just make that particular option passe. I really think that needs to be specified and emphasized as being a resolution to all these, you know, potentially all these issues. And so to say in this comment, this particular part, to comment that there's no other choice, well, there certainly is one that would be available to an IGO there. That's with regard to, I guess, just part of that new bullet point. As to the end, the final clause where it says, or allow infringing conduct to continue by not filing the complaint in the first place, it seems to me that that's somewhat inflammatory, if not unnecessary. I mean, we're not using similar language in option two for domain registrants. I mean, we're not asking, you know, we don't have a comment in option two about would introducing option two effectively force a registrant not to oppose a UDRP or an arbitration appeal and thus allow their domain to be hijacked. I mean, we're not asking those kind of, you know, I'm not sure that really helps per se. So I don't have a resolution necessarily what that should be, but I just question whether or not that, you know, if that's particularly helpful. With regard to the prior bullet point, We've already discussed this before, but I've really been chewing on it now for 2 or 3 weeks, and just decided it was time to make a comment about that. The bullet point says, would the possibility that a decision against the registrant be vitiated in the circumstances where the IGO has successfully claimed jurisdictional immunity, would that create a greater incentive for a losing registrant to seek relief in the courts? And I think the issue that I have here is if vitiation is posed as an incentive for a registrant, then it's just as likely that the lack of vitiation should likewise be determined perhaps a greater deterrent to a losing registrant for seeking relief. And I don't think that's the intention here. So I just wonder if we might want to think of different language that's not quite so. To consider an appeal process or utilizing an appeal as an incentive, I don't think the option here really. I'm not sure that's particularly relevant. Thank you.
Hey, yeah, thank you, Jay. And I'm just going to comment. Those are good points. Looking at this new bullet point, I'm thinking it needs some additional work. It seems a little too almost saying that we put the IGO between a rock and a hard place, when in fact we haven't. We found that the IGOs have standing under Article 6 tier, even if they have no trademark rights independent of that, and that they can avoid any jurisdictional immunity issues in the first place by bringing their complaint through an agent, licensee, or assignee. So we've done a lot here. So this would, an IGO which has chosen to avoid those options and file directly, where it says give up any jurisdictional immunity that it may have, it has no, it only has the immunity that the court says it has. And I don't think it's, I think the last clause, not filing a complaint in the first place, if there's a clear case of infringement, it's going to file the UDRP or URS. It's going to win if it's really clear that there's bad faith use and registration going on. And in at least 99 out of 100 places, there's not going to be a registrant appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction. In fact, in a majority of the cases, there may not even be a response from the registrant in the first place. That's the rule in the majority of UDRPs and URS cases. They're default cases. So I think this needs to be rewritten to be more balanced in the way it states the situation. So the chair took his prerogative to make a statement there. Paul, I'm going to call on you again. Your hand's still up. Please keep it brief. We've got 4 minutes left, and then Lori again.
I will do so. Thank you. This is Paul Keating. I would take away all of these comments and replace it with a simple comment that just simply said everything that you just described about standing and the ability of the IGO to put a stand-in character in their place, okay, to preserve their immunity, those are things that exist right now, today, under the UDRP, widely recognized, okay? So there's nothing my view is now exactly the same as it was in the beginning, which is there's nothing that we need to change in order to deal with this issue, because the IGOs have, to the extent that they have a philosophical problem with or legal problem with sovereign immunity, there's an easy, simple workaround that a clerk in their office can deal with. Okay. Now, in those cases, Phil, where you've clarified that it's clear that they have rights under the UDRP and it's clear that they're going to win, fine. But those are the kind of cases that I want to promote in the UDRP. What I want to want not to promote and to castigate and to disincentivize are the cases of overreaching under the UDRP. Okay, where they say, WHO. Okay. Right? A classic example, right? Okay, so they need to be darn sure that they're correct, right? So I have no problem going overboard in order to make sure that they are incentivized to ensure that their claims are are not, you know, are bulletproof. They're really good claims, right? There are really a lot of bad domain registrants out there. I completely agree, right? But there's a lot of good ones out there.
Okay.
Who
well, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay.
We've got 2 minutes
so
left.
I would eliminate, I agree completely with Jay's comment. I would eliminate all of these bullet points. I would state the obvious that they have a simple workaround to the problem. And if they don't opt for the workaround of the problem, then they are no. Then in essence, they are in the same position that they would have been had the UDRP not existed. We do not take away any rights, substantive or otherwise, that they would have. Okay? Thank you.
Okay. Paul, I'm going to, just for the record, disagree. I think it's useful to have these bullet points explaining, fleshing out this option. It might be worth adding some of your thoughts to them, but I would not be comfortable with just eliminating them. I think parts of our report are going to be controversial. We also want to guide comments on the preliminary draft, and I think this explanation will be useful for that. Lori, it's 12:59, so be brief, please, and then we're going to talk about we didn't get that far today, but we're going to talk about next meeting. So go ahead, Lori, quick comment.
All right, very, very quick. I did talk to Brian Beckham, and in terms of the three options, he said that he essentially agreed with what I thought, and I wanted to share that with the group. In the agency situation, that would not be a workaround because an agent is simply stepping in to the IGO's shoes, and any liability or waivers would absolutely attach to the IGO, according to Brian. Licensing might work, but then you would need some sort of a holding company, same as if an assignment, and that it does require, it's not a simple one-page letter. I'm not clear about what George is referring to, and of course I will look at it, as George is always good at supplying, but from the IGO perspective, this creates a level of corporate involvement that is typically reserved to private companies like DuPont, as opposed to intergovernmental agencies that don't have the same legal department's resources or legal strategies that is seen in the private sector. And I'm just going to stop there.
Okay. Lori, I'll just comment that this group can only look at issues relating to the curative rights processes. We can't deal directly with the economic or legal capacity of various IGOs. That's outside our purview.
I understand that, but if we're saying they're simple solutions and from the point of the IGO they're not, I think we should note that. That why do we assume it's simple if we have an IGO challenging the simplicity? That's all. I would just note the conflict, not make a judgment on it, because I agree we can't judge.
I have to think, Lori, that most IGOs are going to have some legal counsel that they could call on to file on their behalf. It's a general problem with any adjudication system that to utilize it, you have to have some resources to make use of it. And if ICANN wants to set up, some party wants to propose that the last resort auction fund, that some part be put aside for IGO support for CRP filings, that's one more idea that may pop up when they get ideas on how to use that money. But we don't have any authority there. I'm going to have to call this discussion to a close. We're 2 minutes past the hour. Staff, are we up?
One second, because I want to bridge a gap. Lori, can you please email me at paul@law.es with your contact details, because I want to continue this conversation with you.
Absolutely, Paul. No problem.
Okay. That's great. And
perfect.
If Paul and Lori can bring something together back to our attention, that would be great. I believe our next meeting is at the same time next Thursday, the 13th. Is that correct, staff?
Hi, everyone. This is Mary. Phil, that is correct. And we did have a question for you and Petter about the timing of the following meeting. But essentially, we would have two more working group meetings before the planned one-week break right before Hyderabad. So given where we are with this draft document and the likelihood that we will see the small group proposal, I think in planning for the next two meetings, we probably want to look ahead to our session in Hyderabad as well.
Right. And Mary, I just saw a draft calendar for Hyderabad. I saw that on one day there's like a 30 minutes. This working group and a lot of others have a 30-minute session, which I guess is the view from 20,000 feet session. Do we have both that and a much more focused working group, actual working group session in Hyderabad? Do you know?
Yes, I believe that short session may be part of the update to the GNSO, and I think the idea there, given our working group's state of progress, is that we would talk about our preliminary recommendations. But yes, we did put in a separate request for a separate session. I apologize, I haven't looked at the latest version of the schedule to figure out where that is, if it's there at all.
Okay. And so far as the focus of our meeting next week, I think that'll be up to the co-chairs in consultation with staff once we see this letter that's supposed to emerge from the board later today regarding issues that are relevant to our work. So we're going to have to we're going to need to get back to this section and to the broader report and finalizing a preliminary report that can be put out for public comment. But we may need to devote a session to discussing that board letter once we see it. So any last comments or any other business before I shut down the meeting at 5 minutes past the hour?
No, Phil, this is you. Staff. We just want a really quick one to ask the working group to look again at the policy options especially and just make sure that you're comfortable with what it says. As also, if you have an opinion as to, you know, further text we need to add there, and also consideration of the UNSA trial rules, which I think we said a couple of weeks ago we may need to spend a little bit more time on. So just a request that between now and the next draft, if folks could take a look at that, that would be very helpful.
Okay. And Mary, I think since not everyone in the working group is on this call, it would be good for staff to send out a note to that effect to all members with a reference to the exact material you were talking about. Okay.
Will do. Sure.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
I'm going to pull the plug on this meeting at 6 minutes past. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Phil. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you so much. Again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator, stop the recording and disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great day, everyone.